presentation in our Mythbuster series. Tonight we'll be discussing new food for thought, mealtime myths. Before we begin tonight's topic, I want to just comment on two things that I mentioned last week. The first one being less significant but important to note, and that is that I had stated incorrectly that the Maharil lived approximately 400 years ago. I guess I should have realized that would not be possible because the Maharil is often quoted by the Ramah. But the Maharil died in the year 1427, so therefore the Maharil would have lived around 600 years ago. The other point that I want to mention is last week I took a few minutes to talk about the fact that, let's see if I can remember what Rabbi Ner said, how to prepare for Pesach cheerfully in less than one day, right? Undoubtedly, if you were here, you remember that particular one, right? And I think it was particularly memorable for some is I showed you a picture of a house and we were throwing loaves of bread all over the place. And I said, you know, at the end of the day, you know, what's the big deal? Do we really have to make ourselves crazy to remove these? So I feel, especially because I heard from one or two people afterwards, you know, that deserves, you know, some sort of qualification. And I believe the record will show, you have to go back to the recording, that I probably made this point, but maybe not clear enough. And that is that it's true that if you actually had big pieces of edible food in these rooms, let's say on your bed or under your bed, or if in the office where you work you had a box of donuts sitting right there. So technically speaking, if you actually went ahead and you do a bittul, you would not be in violation of this by Rabbi Matzeh, but you're still required to do what's called a bidikas chametz and a biur chametz to get rid of all chametz because we are concerned, number one, that you may forget, or you may come even to regret that decision. You say, you know what, I know what I said last week, but now I really want to go ahead and eat this chametz. But what the point I was making last week is that we, for the most part, hopefully we maintain pretty clean homes anyway, so we don't actually have big pieces of food that are lying around the house. And if they are, they're probably not going to be edible anyway at a certain point. But it's the small pieces, the pieces that are perhaps, like I said, under the refrigerator or behind the dresser in the bedroom, under the bed, which in all likelihood you'll never find. And if you did find, you'd never eat. And if you would eat, perhaps at that point it would be nifsa miyachilas kelev anyway. It's not even edible. So there really is no reason to start moving furniture and start, you know, taking anything out of the drawers and wiping them clean. But the particular illustration that I gave you last week of whole loaves of bread, you know, falling from the sky into the room. So obviously, it goes without saying that we would want to remove those from our home. And if that's the kind of house you have, then you probably have to clean your house in about 2 days, and it may not be as cheerful. But other than that, you know, we're going to stick with the protocol the way we presented last week. So this week, we're going to talk about new food for thought, mealtime myths. We're going to present, I believe, 9 myths tonight having to do with things related to food and mealtime. The first myth, we cover the challah while making kiddush because we don't want to embarrass the challah. Right? Now, we've all heard this. We've shared this with our children, and we've made a great effort, undoubtedly, cover the challah because we don't want the challah to be embarrassed. Now, let's start this discussion by thinking about this as you know, rational adults over here. So here you have two challahs. Looks familiar. We can call them Max and Sadie, just two nice-looking challahs. And we're going to cover them because we're concerned that they're going to be embarrassed, right? And then moments later, what are we going to do? We're going to cut them into pieces. And just a couple of seconds later, we're going to actually go ahead and eat them. So, you know, I don't know if your kids ever asked you this question, but if they did, you know, I'd be impressed if you can come up with a satisfactory answer to that question. After all, we're concerned about embarrassing the challah, but we have no problem whatsoever about dismembering it and eating it. So that's something that really requires an explanation. On the other hand, there is a basis to this, undoubtedly. So what's going on over here? So it actually says in Shulchan Aruch, Tzorach shetei mapal shulchan tachas apas, you have to have a covering, a tablecloth. We actually have a tablecloth usually, and an actual challah board, as we call it, under the bread. Umapa cheres prusal gabav. And you also want to have another covering on top of the bread. And the reason, says the Mishnah Berurah, is in the Torah, in the name of Yerushalmi, it says, Shela yira hapas boshto, because we do not want the what? Literally, the pas to be embarrassed. So it would seem that there is, in fact, a basis to this idea. But if you read on in the Mishnah Berurah, the way the Mishnah Berurah helps us understand what this means, you realize that perhaps we are translating this term a little too literally. Says the Mishnah Berurah, She'ein mekadshin alav el alayayin. Because what we do on Friday night and Shabbos during the day is we make Kiddush on wine, not on the bread. V'hu yesh lo din kadima b'shari mekomos. In all other places, so the protocol is you make a bracha on bread first, and then you will then eat other foods. But over here, we deviate. We depart from that protocol. Therefore, says the Mishmur, a very unusual situation. Let's say you don't have wine. You're forced to make Kiddush on the bread. If that's so, you don't have to cover it. You don't have to. The idea over here of embarrassing the bread, which is used over here in a perhaps in a more figurative sense, is that because we are trying to sensitize ourselves to the fact that we are departing from normal practice. Normally, bread comes first. Tonight, the bread yields to the wine, and so therefore we cover it. So the idea is, number one, that that's where the boshes come from.
But what about the man? The man had to cover up.
Oh, very good. Continues the Mishnah Berurah. V'alatam achar shekasav ator. The Torah brings another reason, nothing to do with embarrassing the bread. Shu zecha l'man. Shehayimunach b'kupso tal l'mala v'tal l'mata. The man came in a nice container that was due below and due above. So then you would say, even if you are making Kiddush on bread, you should still cover it. Because there's a completely different reason. It's a zeichel aman v'chein nogim, and this would be our custom. So halacha l'maisa, if you would ever make Kiddush on bread, you would still want to cover it because of this other reason, a zeichel aman. Interestingly, Mr. Brewer points out another possible nafkamin, a practical difference between these two reasons. U'mashma b'pim agadim. According to what? All the reasons. It's sufficient to cover the challah just until you finish making Kiddush. V'chein b'shachar, same as too during the daytime. Tzarech gam kein liyosa pas b'chus arachar Kiddush, mitam me'elu. Chayozim says, mashma delatam zeich laman, tov shi m'chus arachar b'chus hamotzi. In other words, if you assume like the first reason, then once you've made Kiddush, at that point you could remove the cover. Most of us, I don't think, do that. I think most of us keep the challah covered until we come to the table to cut it. The Chayyadim says, actually, you should keep it covered throughout that time because of the reason of Zeich Laman. So, in the end, one need not be concerned about hurting the challah's feelings. It is a nice idea, by the way, I should say, the idea of sensitizing ourselves and our children to feelings, so to speak, of even inanimate objects is a good way of sensitizing ourselves to in general, so that we could be concerned about hurting the feeling of other people. It goes without saying, if somebody would be only concerned about hurting the challah and not the people, so then that would be a big problem. So in general, it can't hurt to be concerned about everyone's feelings, but the truth of the matter is, the challah doesn't really have feelings, and that was really just a myth. Okay, the next myth. On Shabbos and Yom Tov, it is customary to dip challah in salt. Now, the truth is, this is not a myth, this is a fact. It is customary, and that's not what we are disputing tonight. The question is this special to Shabbos and Yom Tov, right? Most of us, again, I imagine, do not go out of our way necessarily to take salt and bring it to the table any other day of the week. But on Shabbos and Yom Tov, we are very makpid to do so. Imagine coming to the table on Friday night and Shabbos and there's no salt on the table. So, you're going to hold everything up in order to go ahead and get the salt, right? Says the Shulchan Aruch Archaim Simen Kuf Samach Zayin. This should already give you an indication that there's nothing to do with Shabbos, because Simen Kuf Samach Zayin is found in the laws of Hilchos Suda. This has nothing to do with the laws of Shabbos. Says the Shulchan Aruch, Lo Yivtza Ad Sheyaviu Lefan of Melach O Liftan. A person should not actually break bread, you should not sit down to make its Birchas Hamotzi, until you have either salt or Liftan, says Rashi. That means Kol Davar Shanechal Mapas. That means anything which is normally eaten together with bread, such as a dip of some sorts. And the reason is, l'lafis b'prusas ha'betzi, in order to be able to dip the bread into something, v'imhi nekiya, o she'yu metuvelis b'tavlin, o b'melach ke'en shalanu, eino tzorech l'hamtin. However, if the flour that was used for the bread is already fine flour, or there were ingredients such as salt and other sweetening products and spices or something like that was placed into the bread to begin with, so technically speaking, you don't have to wait for the salt. It's not necessary. The Rama says, Mikol makom mitzvah laniach al kol shulchan melach kodem shiyivtza. Says the Rama, nevertheless, it is our custom that we always have salt on the table. Ki hashulchan dama lemizbeach v'achila k'korban. A beautiful idea that the table that we have today in our homes is commemorative, is symbolic of the mizbeach that we had in the Beis Hamikdash, and would bring food to the table. It's commemorative of a korban. The Nema in the pasuk says, "I'll call korbancha takriv melach." That with all of the korbanos, they are brought with salt. V'hu megin min apranios. An idea, somewhat of a mystical idea, that salt as well is something which could protect us from pranios, from unfortunate events in our life. And so, therefore, the Ramash stresses that it is important that even if the bread tastes good the way it is, and even if it doesn't need salt, right, from the perspective of a recipe, nevertheless, there's still a tradition that we bring it to the table. And again, because the table is doma lemizbeach. The Kaf HaChaim brings down Al Pi Kabbalah, some ideas over here that I put it down here originally thinking that by the time I would actually be standing here, I'd be able to figure out what he's saying, but I can't. I really can't understand. All I know is that he says that the word Lechem and Melach have the same letters, and he talks over here about the secrets of God's name, and somehow when we go ahead and we dip the bread into the salt, so somehow that on some celestial, cosmic, mystical level, I'm not sure what, has some great significance. Note, by the way, that picture is pouring the salt on the bread, and it seems to me that if you look carefully at the sources, the idea over here seems to be of dipping again, at least as far as achieving this mystical objective over here, of dipping the bread into the salt as opposed to pouring the salt on the bread. As far as the first concern, the more of the rational one, just to make sure that the bread tastes good, so then it really wouldn't make a difference whether you pour it or not. Now, the question is there anything special about Shabbos over here? Everything that we mentioned so far has nothing to do with Shabbos and Yom Tov. So the answer is, the only thing that I was able to find that shows that Shabbos is different is the following. In the Sefer Pesukei Juvos, it brings down that the minhag of the Chasam Sofer was not to dip challah in salt on Shabbos. That was the only thing that I could find about Shabbos. The Chasam Sofer says, he didn't do it. Didn't do it. Mikom akom tzarech shia melech al shulchan. Nevertheless, he was makbit that there should be salt on the table. Interestingly, in the Sefer Divrei HaRav, the third volume of Rav Schechter's Sefer, which deals with different halachos and hanhagos and traditions from Soloveitchik, he quotes from here from Rabbi Neil Turk from Miami, now lives in Teaneck actually, who heard from the Rav's sister that it was her father's custom, meaning the Rav's father, Moshe Soloveitchik, not to dip bread in the salt on Friday night. And he wasn't sure what the reason is. Maybe it's because the chal already tasted good and didn't need salt. Or maybe because the reason why we do it, as we mentioned already, is because the shulchan is dama l'mizbeach and the achil is dama l'korban, and it happens to be that we do not burn anything on the mizbeach on Friday night. He says a nafkamina would perhaps be what about Shabbos day? Anyway, so you see there's an idea, a tradition in the Soloveitchik family as well. And then Rav Schechter writes on the bottom that he heard from Rabbi Ganak that the Soloveitchik family in Eretz Yisrael never use salt. Even during the week, kibiz manenu tamid masim and ketzas melach b'paskus. There's always at least a little salt in the recipe. V'hi tamid timan, it always tastes good. So it would seem that it is a myth. That the fact is that it is customary to dip bread in salt at all times, if in fact you have that custom. If you don't have that custom, as we see some, so then okay, never. But the idea that we only do it on Shabbos and Yom Tov seems to be a myth. Next myth: the utensil which requires tefillah may be used once before immersion. Now this is a myth that if it were true would be very handy, right? There's always that moment, whether it's when you're having company, you're traveling, and you want to buy a grill along the way and have a little barbecue in the park, and many other scenarios that come up where you're not just being lazy, but it would be very, very convenient, needless to say, to get this one freebie, right? Where the first time is on the house, and then God says, but now you have to bring it to the mikvah, right? So this is a myth. Many of us have heard of it. The idea of tefillas kelim, according to many, is actually a requirement from the Torah. The pasuk says, in Sefer Midbar, pasuk Perek Lamed Aleph, Kol davar asher yavo ba'esh tavir ba'esh v'taher, ach b'bein idayis chatov v'chol asher lo yavo ba'esh tavir b'mayim. The Torah describes that after the war with Midian, and Bnei Yisrael capture many of the spoils of war, so they take for themselves dishes and plates and pots and all different things. And the Torah describes a process of purification. Now the truth is, in this pasuk over here, you have two different procedures, which we sometimes confuse, but they're really different. One is purging or kashering kalim which have been used beforehand for non-kosher food. That's a completely different discussion. Separate from that, our rabbis note that there's an obligation over here to take kalim that were previously owned by a non-Jew and put in the mikveh before the first time you use it. The Mishnah in Avodah Zarah tells us, Halokeach kli tashmish min avodik chavim, somebody who goes ahead and takes a vessel, a utensil that is going to be used for at the table with food from a non-Jew, as shadarka lahatbil yatbil, that which it is customary normally to bring it to the mikveh, we do. The Shulchan Aruch says, if you buy a keli from a non-Jew, kli suda, whether it's mateches or zechuches, whether it's made of a metal or glass, afal pi sheim chadashim, even if they're brand new, straight out of the box, never been used before, so then they should be dipped in the mikveh, omayin shalabayim sa. Note, of course, that we're talking over here about something that was purchased by or made by a non-Jew, that if you, let's say, somebody actually just asked me the question very recently, somebody went glass blowing and they actually made their own glass. You don't hear about people doing that too often. Pottery sometimes people do, but that we don't take the mikveh anyway. So they want to know where they have to be tovel in the mikveh. So the answer is they don't have to, because they're the first owner, they created it. This comes right from the Tinek Mikveh Association. This is just sort of a commercial break, but we can't talk about tefillas kalim without just pointing out that certain things require tefillah with a bracha, certain require tefillah without a bracha, and for some tefillah is not required. So with a bracha, stainless steel, gold, silver, lead, iron, glass, crystal, and metal. Tefillah, immersion without a bracha, aluminum, Corning, Warren, Corel. And would not tefillah not require at all would include Israeli-made products. Again, the assumption being that if it's coming from Israel, so then it was manufactured by and owned by and sold by Jews. Plastic and china, including glazed porcelain, according to Moshe Feinstein, that was a machlokas haposkim as to whether or not glazed china requires. Mentions on the bottom, stickers and glue remnants should be removed before immersion. Okay, so that's just about tefillas kalim in general. But what's this whole idea about one time you can get away without using? Where does that come from? So, if you take a look at Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah is very clear. Asur l'shtamish bo l'tzorchei su'udah, afilu derech harai b'lo tefillah. You're not permitted to go ahead and use it, again, at the meal, for the purpose of preparing, handling food, even derech harai, even temporarily, meaning I just haven't gotten around to it yet, without first taking it to the mikveh. So, this sort of only strengthens the question. So, it would seem that this myth came about from the following discussion. The poskim talk about what happens when you're dealing with disposable kalim. What if you buy something, as many of us do, something looks like that. Disposable aluminum tin pans come in all different shapes and sizes, which you're only going to use once and then you're going to throw it away. So the question over here is, that does that have the status of a keli anyway? Is this something which is even mekabel tuma, which requires tefillah in the mikveh at all? So here you had a machlokas haposkim. Rav Moshe Feinstein over here, and the first Tshuva quoted over here, talks about this. And he wants to perhaps differentiate between something which is typically, something which could be used on a regular basis, but often people just throw it out, and something which is so flimsy, and even if they wanted to use it more than a couple of times, they couldn't. Many poskim discussed this several decades ago. They find many tshuvas to talk about over here from Menashe Klein in the bottom. Basically, rules l'chumra in this particular situation. He says the bottom line is, if you have something and it's good enough for whatever meal that you're preparing, then that's considered a keli and you should bring it to the mikveh. If you're missing this point, what I'm saying is that according to some poskim, these aluminum pans right here have to be taken to the mikveh. Rav Moshe Feinstein, however, disagreed, and he said that if you use it two, three times, and then you throw it, you don't have to take it to the mikveh. If you can use more than that, you should. If you look at the OU website, their policy, which they apply for, I guess, for their caterers and stores, disposable aluminum pans do not require tefillah. Some authorities require it if they're sturdy enough to be reused two or three times. So this is a debate. If you're interested in knowing what to do, you should consult your local Orthodox rabbi. But the bottom line is, it is a myth that a utensil which requires tefillah may not be used even once before immersion. Recently, I had a conversation with somebody about this, and he said, oh, it's just like trying on a suit before you check it for shatness. That's so interesting, the way people, their minds think. Now that, it, conceptually, assuming this myth would have been true, would have been a perfect analogy. But the logic is all wrong. The reason why a person can try on a suit, let's say, before checking it for shatness, is not because you have one time free. It's because of the fact that most articles of clothing that we buy don't contain shatness. And in that particular case, what are you going to do? You're gonna go to the guys in the store and say, listen, I'm going to take these three suits, have them checked for shadows, I'm gonna come back and try it on. I'm not gonna go for that. So we rely in that situation on what's called a rov. Most suits don't contain shatnez, and therefore, in a situation where you cannot check otherwise, so then we rely on the rov. The reality is that if, let's say, you bought a suit and you needed to wear it that day and you didn't get around to checking it for another day or two, you could rely on that same rov. That's very different than over here. There's no rov over here. Over here, we're saying the kalim really need to be taken to the mikvah. So these are one of those situations where I guess, you know, you may think of situations like this and say, oh, it all seems analogous, but the situation is very different. Okay, the next myth is mezonos bread. That's the myth. The myth is mezonos bread. Right? You ever hear of mezonos bread? I'll give you some visuals over here. This comes from Western kosher. I've never heard of Western Galak kosher. Pastrami sandwich. And it says in very big letters, if you can't see it, mezonos bread. Here's mezonos. Pas Yisrael, finally, real authentic rye baked to perfection with a real mezonos recipe. Really good. Corn's mezonos white bread. Turkey sandwich. Amazing. All of this is mezonos bread. Of course, these come in handy, especially on the plane, where they often serve them, but other places as well. The concept of mezonos bread is a great invention. Why did it take us till the 21st century to think about something as convenient as mezonos bread? You never have to wash, right? Parenthetically, when my kids sometimes say to me, do I have to wash? So my response is, anybody know my response? Did I tell you before? I say, you get to wash. Doesn't usually work. But you don't have to wash. You don't have to bench. Right? You get to. Okay, anyway. The Shulchan Aruch says in Siman Kuf Samach Zayin, that's the same Siman we saw earlier, Hilchos Suda, Botzei B'Pas, Yivarei Chamotzi Lechem Min Ha'aretz. When a person makes a bracha on bread, the bracha is, as we all know, Hamotzi Lechem Min Ha'aretz. You know that. That's the bracha you make on bread. So what's there to even discuss? So later on, in the next Siman in Shulchan Aruch, it says, Pas Habo B'Kisnin, which we'll define in a moment, a certain type of bread, you make a bracha Bari Min Mezonos. And afterwards you make Birchas Mein Shelosh. Instead of saying Birchas HaMazon, what we call benching, you say an Alamichya. So what is Pas Habo B'Kisnin? So the Shulchan Aruch goes on to explain. Pas Habo B'Kisnin, Yesh Mefarshim, there are different opinions in the Rishonim as to what it means. Some say, it's Pas She'asui Kamin Kisim. It's bread that's made almost like a little pocket. Shemimalim Osam Dvash Osukar Ve'egozim Mishkedim Atavlim. Sound familiar? Right? Well, we would probably call it Danish. It says over here something that looks like Rugalach. I don't think what it says, but some word in the Shulchan Aruch says Rishkalish or Rikhalish. Okay, whatever. It's probably a similar type of snack. Said the Shulchan Aruch, there's another opinion, and that is something which is kneaded with a lot of sugar or oil, milk, something that gives it a very, very sweet taste. It doesn't taste like bread. That seems to be the condition over here, the Mishnah Berurah, which I didn't put over here. The Mishnah Berurah highlights this point. Pas Habo B'Kisnin is something that tastes like cake. That's how you know. Is there enough sugar? Is there enough honey? I sometimes joke with my wife, if you've ever had my wife's challah, so people sometimes comment, you know, it tastes like dessert. The truth is, you have to be careful. Some of the bakeries were making, maybe they still do, I don't know, it's been a long time since I had bakery challah, Baruch Hashem, but, some of them were making challahs that they were completely indistinguishable. You couldn't tell. They had chocolate and raisins and all the things, and you pull them apart, it looked like a babka. It was the exact same thing. At a certain point, the shaila is, what bracha are you going to make? Now, there's another point, and that's also relevant to the discussion, and that is, Pas Habo B'Kisnin, you say a bari min mezonos, and after a bracha min shalosh. However, if you eat the amount that a person would normally eat to be kovei asuda, even if you yourself have not been satisfied by this, so then you make a birchas hamotzi. Meaning, even if, going back to this previous slide, let's say you go ahead and you take out, I wouldn't recommend this, you take out a box of donuts, and you say, here's my lunch, and you can have 3-4 donuts. So the halacha seems to be, you should wash, you should make hamotzi, and you should bench. That's what most people would have for a meal. So Pas Habo B'Kisnin, when would you make a mezonos? You'd make a mezonos if it's something that we said was so sweet, was so tasty, that was really something we would call like a cake or a Danish, rugelach, donut, whatever you want to call it, a cookie. And assuming you didn't eat enough, then it should actually be considered a meal. This is a topic in which we could easily spend an hour discussing because I don't want to oversimplify things here, but going back to these pictures over here, you decide for yourself, you know, turkey sandwich, mazonis bread. I haven't tasted this mazonis bread, this corn's mazonis bread, but it certainly doesn't look like an Entenmann's donut. It looks like bread and probably tastes just like bread. And if you look in the ingredients, they'll tell you they use a little fruit juice, but the reality is that the juice that they use is probably doesn't even qualify as being true fruit juice to the extent that it would even the question even really gets off the ground. So the reality is that it's just a myth. Now, if you go to the OU website, they have an interesting article about this topic, and it says 5 years ago, some members of the rabbinic staff of the OU questioned the legitimacy of the mazonos roll concept for reasons which we explain below. The issue arose because the word mazonos was prominently stamped on the cellophane wrapper of rolls, which are part of the OU certified frozen meals. After reviewing this matter with the OU's halachic consultants, Rav Yisrael Belsky, Zechon Levracha, and Rav Herschel Schechter Shlita, and the Rabbinical Council of America, the OU took the bold position that the phrase mazonos roll is an oxymoron. Rolls and mazonos cannot coexist. Mazonos roll is a spurious term, and the correct bracha for the so-called mazonos roll is hamotzi lechem and aretz with netilas adayim a prerequisite. This change in policy was not without strong public comment. Irate travelers wrote the OU in protest and demanded a return to the state of mazonos roll bliss. In fact, one angry caller pointed to the author the OU policy could result in sakanos nefashos, life-threatening situations. Rabbi, don't you realize that if everybody would stand up and walk to the back of an airline in the Washington Zil Sadaim, the entire aircraft would tip over. Nonetheless, the OU stuck to its guns, and I am happy to report that we have never received a report of an airplane capsizing because of a rush to the washing station. So the bottom line is, according to, and I say this without any hesitation, according to the majority, to my knowledge, all poskim that have written about this topic, so it's not just OU policy and Kafke policy, and you look at all the Hashgach agencies, but really all poskim that treat this question in a serious way, that really mazonos bread is an oxymoron, and there is no such thing as mazonos bread. That being said, you may find yourselves in situations where you can't wash, and that becomes a different question as to how you handle situations when you have bread and you can't wash. But the bracha is certainly going to be a motzi and requires a berachas hamazon afterwards.
What
yes.
About the colors which have marshmallow and raisins?
That's what I'm saying.
That would be.
I think raisins is for sure still bread. There's something called raisin bread. Marshmallow is a little strange concept, but I think probably there as well. It's been several years since I saw these. Was this just a fad, or they're still around? They had some bakeries that were making, you know, challah that really, really looked like bread. So I don't have an actual sheer measurement that I can give you and say it has to be this sweet. But it is a question. It is a question. If it's really the kind of thing that could really be served for dessert. So then it's probably a shiloh whether you can even make a motz. Now, the truth is, you may be thinking, wait a second, I'm going to eat so much of it. So what's the difference? I think you could probably still make a case that it's probably still best to make a hamotzi on something which is true bread, l'chachila, but I may be wrong at that point. I'm not sure. I guess if you're going to tell me, you can eat a lot of it. Yeah. So that's different. That's probably, it sounds like bread which has something added, you know, put it on top of it afterwards, as opposed to something which is baked with honey or sugar or something like that. Yeah? Right. There's a big shot about bagels. Here in America, we wash and bench it on bagels. In England, they don't. England is they don't. They don't. So it's as far as them as well. So I just thought about even the Ashkenazim in England, they don't. So there are different opinions when it comes to different types of breads. There are a lot of things which are just custom. Bagels are somewhat of a new concept. Myth. When reciting Birkas HaMazon together with a minyan on Shabbos, Yom Tov, or at a Sudas Mitzvah, it is proper to recite the benching over a cup of wine. So this is another sort of misleading myth, the way it's formulated over here. This is not a myth, this is a fact. It is customary. Many of us have this practice that when we have a minyan together on Shabbos or Yom Tov or a Sudas Mitzvah, such as a bris or a wedding, whatever the case is, we recite benching over a cup of wine. So what is the myth over here? The myth is that it has anything to do with Shabbos or Yom Tov or a Sudas Mitzvah or a Minyan. Let's take a look. Now, here's just some pictures. I wasn't looking for the pictures. I Googled online. I said, you know, benching a la kos. And these are the pictures that came up. And all of them had people sitting either at some nice, big, lavish. They all look like Sudas Mitzvah. This is the association that's made. If you look in Shulchan Aruch and Kuf Pei Beis, it says, Yesh Omim Shebirkas Amazon Tuna Kos Afilu B'yachid. There is an opinion in the Rishonim that says, and this is quoted in Shulchan Aruch, this is not the final word over here, but whenever a person benches, even if they're by themselves, you should take out a cup of wine and make because of mazon ala kos. Just like you make Kiddush or Havdalah. These are mitzvahs that we recite ala kos. There is such an opinion. V'yesh yomrim, she'ena tuna kos ala b'shlosha. There's another opinion that says, not only when you have what we call a mezumin, when you're benching b'zimin, so then you do. V'yesh yomrim, she'ena tuna kos klal. And then there's a third opinion that says, you don't require a kos at all, afilu b'shlosha, even if you have three. The Ramah says, and most of us traditionally follow the minhag of the Ramah, nevertheless, it is considered to be mitzvah menamuvchah, which means proper, ideal, to bench halakos. The Mishnah Berurah qualifies over here as talking about when you have a zimun. When you're benching a zimun, it is proper to bench halakos. It is not required. It is not required, but this seems to be, quoting from the Ran over here, what is preferable. The Aruch HaShulchan lived about 150 years ago, says the following. It is very clear that even according to those who say you do not require a kos, it is still considered to be preferable. From the Gemara, you seem to get the impression they did this all the time, and probably because wine is very cheap. He says, therefore, whenever wine is cheap and people use it all the time, it's not difficult to obtain wine. So it's proper for a person as Yorei Hashem to bench halakos, especially when you're benching b'zimun. Umimidino seinu, he says, but in our times, in our places, iafshem epnesha ein lanu yayin, because we don't have wine as much. V'gam ha'yayin shanu osim b'tzumukim hu b'yoker. The wine that we buy is very expensive. Af gam sheicha b'yoker ve'in yodein maseges likach l'chosu d'kosha bracha. Even purchasing beer is expensive. We can't afford this. Ach, he says, ha'ashirim. By the way, if you're not catching on yet, that's us. Wealthy ones. Sheshosim sheicha b'chosu d'vadai d'lehem nor l'verach ha'kos v'ashameyas baruch min ha'shamayim. It's the right thing to do. And he says, one who listens to me will be blessed min ha'shamayim. The Piskei Tshuvos, however, of course, you've seen already, because I've quoted him several times, that's my go-to guy when I'm trying to help us out a little here, because we, you know, very, very few of us actually do this. He says, apia divrei aposkim near the cave of the maskanas of Magen Avraham. The poskim seems to say that since Magen Avraham says, like the third opinion, that you don't have to, and since over the span of history, many people found it to be very prohibitive, no pun intended over there, to buy wine. So, even what? Av shehoi yayin bebayis hayu muat v'yakov v'yishom v'asal mitzvahs kiddush v'avdol. Even the people who had in the house, it was expensive and they didn't have so many, they would save it for Shabbos. So therefore, lo ekpidu alkach. And that may explain why the custom sort of evolved that we don't bench halakos. He says, and even for those like us today, who wine is very common and it's not expensive, for many people, it's difficult to drink wine all the time because it's not good for their stomach or make them tired or they don't like it. So these are reasons where we could be makel. But all of this is what we call a limitz chus. We're trying to rationalize or to justify the minhagim of Klal Yisrael, because people don't seem to be makbid. But Vadai says, for those who can and those who are able, it's the right thing to do. It says, yachid enogim levarach al-koska. However, for one individual, we don't seem to find that at all. So we seem to be saying, when you're benching b'zimun, whether it's in a Shabbos or Yom Tov or Sudas Mitzvah, or just a Tuesday lunch, it is proper to bench al-kos. But if you don't, okay, so that seems to be an established minhag. I would also say, this is I'm not going to regret saying this, but I'm not quite sure that I know how I feel about what I'm about to say, but I personally have just my own concerns about the use of wine and alcohol in general, and particularly in settings, religious settings, and this is good because we're within a week before Purim, so it's good to remind everyone. In case you didn't know this, and even if it doesn't affect you, it's important to know that alcohol abuse among teenagers in the Orthodox community is up again, and it's on the rise again for the last few years. I don't necessarily know why, but that's a fact. So I think we need to be very concerned in general about the extent to which we use wine. I'm not suggesting we have to get all the wine out of our home and we can never have wine, we shouldn't wine for Kiddush or Avdol, etc. Although in certain situations, that certainly is the appropriate thing to do. I've had the Shaila many times where people having guests, let's say, at the Shabbos table or even the Pesach Seder, people who are still in the early stages of recovery from an alcohol addiction, and that's a very, very serious situation. We're not talking about that. So we're not going to say we're just going to ban alcohol altogether. But if the reality is that right now the minhag seems to be that we don't run to pick up a cup of wine every time we bench, you know, I'm not sure necessarily that we shouldn't consider other factors before deciding we want to run into this direction. If that makes sense, great. And if I've just confused you, my apology. But the bottom line is, the fact is, that's not a myth. Whenever we're saddened because of Muzzin with the Zimun, it is proper to bench on a cup of wine, not only on Shabbos Yom Tov. Myth. This is an important one to me. I'll explain why in a moment. When a pot must be kosher, then all the contents of the pot are forbidden for consumption. Here's a common situation. Well, let's move on first. The Torah says, actually, over here, I've quoted the first time it's found in the Torah, Parshas Mishpatim. But the truth is, the Torah says three times, lo sevashel gedi b'chalev imo, that we should not literally cook a baby goat, a kid, in its mother's milk. But from here, we learn that there's an issur basa b'chalev, that you cannot have meat and milk cooked together. Midrabanan, we extend that to poultry as well. And we are careful not to have milk and meat at the same time, at the same meal, even if they're not cooked together. In fact, when we have meat, we wait a period of time, bin suda la suda, 3 hours, some have 1 hour, 6 hours, 5 hours, all different customs. But we separate meat and milk. That's not much of a discussion. And therefore, we know, we don't have to discuss this, we don't have, for example, cheeseburgers. However, most of the shilas that come up for people who are paying attention to what they're doing in the kitchen look like shilas that come up in a situation like this. By the way, I Googled messy kitchen. This was the least offensive picture that came up. If you really want a good laugh, Google messy kitchen, and there were some really really obscene ones that came up. But this was one that was okay. Yeah, we've more or less seen things like this from time to time. So here's where shilas come up, and it's not uncommon for people to call with the following type of a shayla. I used a fleishik pot and I made a milchik soup, or I used a milchik pot and I made a fleishik stew or something like that. And of course, I threw out the soup, and of course, I threw out the stew, but my question is, what do I need to do with the pot? And I always regret getting the call at that point, because what I'm about to show you is very often people throw out the food before they should. Now, in all fairness, there are sometimes people call me, and they haven't yet thrown out the food. And even after I tell them, it's put to eat the food, they still won't eat it. They still won't eat it. I can't do that. I'm not going to argue with you. But so if one wants to be frumer than the Shulchan Aruch, I can't. I mean, it's good food. I don't know that it's right to throw it out. But I understand there are times that people, by the way, you should know, it's interesting. It's often the same people who have these shilas and say that, who'll say, by the way, now I'm so embarrassed, I know you'll never eat in my home. So what I always said, if you ever said that to me, is to the contrary. You know, if you're asking questions about when things go wrong in your house, that's a very good sign. You're right. If one never has questions in the kitchen, so that's a kitchen you need to be concerned about. How is that possible? Nothing ever goes wrong. Just because they don't ask me doesn't mean I wouldn't eat in their house. But you know, people should have questions from time to time. And if someone is really concerned about eating something that they perceive to be treif, okay, that's commendable. But the reality is, let's take a look. In Shulchan Aruch it says, again, I'm just talking about the most common basar b'chalav shayla that comes up. Kideira shebisha b'basar lo yivash b'chalav. If you have a pot that was used to cook meat, you should not use that to cook milk, and vice versa. Vim bisha b'betoch me'isla eis, if you did, within 24 hours since it was last used for meat, osur b'nosin tam. You're not permitted to eat the contents of that pot. You can't eat, let's say, the milchik soup if there is enough. If you don't have what you call bittel, so here's nosin tam, meaning the taste, it doesn't mean you actually could taste it necessarily, but you don't have the required shear in order to be mevatel. V'tzorach l'shayer neger kol hakedera. You have to estimate, take into consideration the size of the pot and how much food was in there, and make that determination. Aval, 1 second. Aval l'mshoa me'eis la'eis kodem shebishaba. However, if let's say you waited 24 hours, and this is the most common situation because people don't typically cook with their pots each and every day. So most often when I ask somebody, is it a ben yomo? Has it been used in 24 hours? 9 out of 10 times, if not more, the answer is no. It has not been. Okay. So then, then the halacha says whatever taste of meat or milk, depending on what you used it for before, was absorbed into the pot and was then expelled into the food, is not going to taste good. Now again, we're talking about probably a metaphysical taste. We're not necessarily talking about something that you can necessarily literally taste. But in halacha, whatever blios, whatever absorptions in the pot, which then come out, since they've been inside the walls of the pot for 24 hours, they're considered to be disgusting. Umutra tavshel, and the food is mutter. Aval kedera osel vashaba lo basaba lo chalav. However, you cannot use the pot again until you kasher it. Some people struggle with this. They find it to be somewhat of a paradox. You're telling me that I can eat the food, but I can't use the pot again until I kasher it? That doesn't make any sense. And the answer is, well, I mean, if we're only using our own logic to understand this, so then it could be a little confusing. But if we use the logic of halacha over here, we understand what's going on, so we understand that that once it's happened, so we wouldn't use this pot again. By the way, that's minhag about the Ashkenazim, that we don't use it. That's the sheet of our mother. We use it again before actually kashering the pot. Here's a nice diagram, a little flowchart over here, which comes from a very nice book. We have it upstairs. It has a like sort of a pictorial guide through many of the most common kashrus shaylos that come up. So here you have cooking meat in a milk pot. So what'd you do? You did it. So it says over here, I'll just walk over here. L'chakhila, once you've done this, so asa levashel, I'm sorry, l'chakhila means l'chakhila, you can't do this. You can't take an inflation pot and use it with milk food. However, but the end, if you did it already, so as far as the pot is concerned, it's asa until you kasher. As far as the meat is concerned, so it depends. If it's a ben yomo, if the pot has been used in the last 24 hours, so then it's probably going to be usher. If not, so then the food is going to be butter. So the reality is that most often, when a pot must be kosher, the contents of the pot are not forbidden for consumption. So if you are concerned about potentially wasting food, it's always best to ask before throwing food out. Sometimes people actually do have to throw the food out. Sometimes people have to throw their pots out. They usually are pots, but sometimes other kalim. That sometimes does happen, but the reality is that we shouldn't make any assumptions. The next myth, whenever you take a drink, you must always make a bracha. Now, this is very intriguing. What does it mean? Of course, that's not a myth, that's a fact. Before I do anything, put anything in my mouth, I have to make a bracha. So let's look, something very interesting, a lot of people don't know this. It says in the Gemara in Brachos, Tav Lamed Hamed Beis, Tanu Rabbanan, Osu Lo La'adam She'enem En'olam Azeb Lo Bracha. A person cannot derive any benefit from this world before reciting a bracha. V'chal Anenem En'olam Azeb Lo Bracha Mo'al. A person who does this is in violation of what's called mi'ila, which means like stealing, but not just stealing from anybody, stealing from God. It's a form of theft from hekdesh, misappropriation of something which has a status of hekdesh. Amar Yehuda Meshmuel kol anenim and olam azeb lo bracha, a person who derives benefit from this world without bracha, ki'ilu nenim yikotche shemayim. Shenemar, as it says, Lashem ha'aretz umloa. The pasuk says, everything belongs to God. And Rabbi Levi says, look, one pasuk says, Lashem ha'aretz umloa, everything belongs to God. And the other pasuk says, "Hashemayim, Shemayim Lashem, v'ha'aretz nasan ve'adam." The other pasuk says, "God gave us the world." Which one is it? Is it His or is it ours? So says the Gemara Lakashia, "Kan l'kolim bracha, kan liacha bracha." Beautiful Gemara. Before you make a bracha, Lashem ha'aretz umloa. After you make a bracha, so then we say, "Ha'aretz nasan livnei adam." At this point, you can partake. So that's of course the rule. We know that. So Shulchan Aruch says there is one exception. Hashose mayim litzama. When a person drinks water because he's thirsty, so then you make a bracha of shakol niyabed varo, and afterwards you make a barna fashas. Aval im chanakte umtsa. If a person is choking, I don't know that it means literally choking, as we'll see in a moment, because then you probably wouldn't make a bracha before anyway. But you have something stuck in your throat. V'shasa mayim laavir umtsa, and you're drinking in order to clear your throat. Einim avarech lo lefana v'lo liachra. In that case, even though you're drinking, you don't make a bracha before or afterwards. The Mishnah Berurah says, Dafka Mayim. This is only water. Why? She'ein achech nena mehem. Because one's palate doesn't benefit from it, meaning there's no taste to it. Unless you're drinking for thirst, because you're thirsty. However, if let's say you need to clear your throat and you drink something else, really anything else other than water, or you, let's say you have a piece of bread in order to clear your throat, so then since you're getting hana, even though that's your only reason, so then you would make a bracha, both in the beginning and the end. And then the Mishabruah says, when you drink water in the morning, a person has to drink a certain amount of water, he's not thirsty. And I don't know, but this was the doctor says you have to drink a certain amount of water and you're not thirsty, or let's say to take it with medicine. So in this situation, you don't make a bracha before or afterwards. Again, note, of course, the difference between water and something like juice, let's say. So this is an interesting halacha that maybe you know, maybe you don't know. The Shulchan Aruch goes on to say, "Kala ochlin v'mashkin shado ochel v'shosu refuah." Anytime a person eats or drinks something for refuah, for medicinal purposes, im tamim tov v'achich nenemihem, if it tastes good and you like it, v'varich aleim tachil v'sof, you should make a bracha. So chicken soup is a great example, right? Normally I wouldn't have chicken soup right now. However, I'm not feeling well. I feel the flu coming on, so I'm going to drink soup. Chicken soup, good, no problem. You should make a bracha. However, if I'm going to take water, let's say to swallow down a pill, I won't. I remember somebody once came here to give a shiur, and we gave him a cup of water, and we brought him a little bottle and a cup. So during the shiur, he opened the bottle, he put it in the cup, and he drank a little water. And I thought that he should have explained why it is that he didn't make a bracha, but he didn't. And there must have been people in the room that were a little confused. Maybe they thought, oh, maybe he'd make a bracha beforehand. But you saw he was opening the bottle, pouring the water. See, probably he needed to clear his throat. He was having a difficult time speaking, and he wanted to take a little water. In that situation, if you're not thirsty and you're only drinking again water for that purpose, so bracha is not recited. But if it's anything else, you would make a bracha. So the fact is, I'm sorry, again, another error over there. The fact, when drinking water to swallow a pill or clear one's throat, a bracha is not recited. Okay, and the last myth of the evening. A giraffe cannot be shechted because we cannot identify the proper place to perform the shechita. Now, of course, this is not something which is most practical, and that's why I left it for the end. But it's interesting. We've all heard this. How come we don't have giraffe meat? After all, giraffe seems to be a kosher animal. You can't tell from this picture, but it does have split hooves, and it does chew its cud. If you like animals and you ever go to the zoo, you could definitely see a giraffe chewing its cud. It's easier to tell than other animals. But it's got a long way up, the elevator, so you can see the whole way up and down and up and down. You see the way it digests its food. So it would seem that a giraffe meets the criteria. However, look at that neck. Who could possibly figure out where to shecht that animal? The Rambam in Hilchos Shechita tells us, "Makom hashechita min achayu atzavar, v'chol atzavar kosher l'shechita." Let's look at that picture again. The proper place to do shechita is the neck, and the entire neck is fine. Look at that, the entire neck. So when we're dealing with a chicken or a cow, let's say, for example, so these are animals that we're more familiar with. Not necessarily all the details of the anatomy of these animals, we know what they look like, and they're much smaller in comparison to the giraffe. There's a great article online written by Rabbi Dr. Ari Zivotofsky, who was actually here probably about 10 years ago. He came, and he presented along with one of his great partners, Dr. Ari Greenspan. Many of you must have read some of their writings and read about them. They're featured in Mishpacha magazine at least once a month because they travel all over the world. They have very, very interesting, fascinating experiences. Rabbi Zivotofsky actually was involved in a famous lawsuit against the State Department, went to the Supreme Court because of, I think that's actually his son, that's what that picture's from, because of the way the State Department printed his, or refused to put Jerusalem as the capital of Jerusalem on his passport. Anyway, so he writes about this topic. And it's very interesting. He says, regarding the Makom Shechita, the Talmud, Chulin 27a, probes for the biblical source that slaughtering must be performed at the neck, and concludes that it is a tradition, a law given to Moshe at Sinai. This would indicate that the entire neck is valid for Shechita. In most animals, one does not have to think about how to define the neck, because it's a relatively small area. In the case of the giraffe, one might contemplate whether the whole neck really is valid, and wonder whether the exact location of the acceptable zone. But there is no need to equivocate. Specific anatomic boundaries for the ritual slaughter of all animals apply to the giraffes as well. For a pigeon, the valid region is a few inches long. For a cow, over 12 inches. For a giraffe, close to 6 feet. A kashrus expert once equipped that anyone who does not know where to shech the giraffe either knows nothing about the laws of shechita or cannot hit the side of a barn with a baseball. So there you go. When I asked Rabbi Yosef Kafich, a leader rabbi and scholar in the Israeli Yemenite community, if there are any halachic impediments to shechting giraffe, his tongue-in-cheek response was that the only problem might be at $10,000 per kilo, it would probably be bal tashchis. It would be very expensive, because the reality is that practically speaking, it is very difficult to actually shech the giraffe. To restrain such an animal is probably dangerous, very costly, and not practical. If I remember correctly, I didn't see this in this article, but I'm almost certain that when they were here, they actually handed around, they passed around, for those who may recall, the hoof of a giraffe. And they said that they actually tasted giraffe meat, and it doesn't taste good at all. It tastes pretty disgusting. So that's probably the reason why it is that Jews don't eat it. If it tastes good, we would have figured out a way already. So that's probably the reason why we don't eat it. However, Rabbi Reisman raises one other reason why maybe we wouldn't. In the book Pathways of the Prophets, he writes, as with most controversies, neither side is entirely right. The idea that it would be difficult to find the proper spot for shechita is indeed absurd. The draft is kosher, and there's no halachic difficulty in the shechita. But wait! Don't rush to invest in the promising new fad. There is a problem. The Ramah limits the consumption of poultry to those birds for which there is a masorah, a tradition that it is kosher. Chachmas Adam Chayu Adam, I'm sorry, Chazon Ish, extend this limitation to wild animals as well, restricting consumption to the deer for which there is a clear masorah. This would be a limiting factor preventing the marketing of giraffe for Ashkenazic Jews. In other words, if you hear that, according to the Ramah, you cannot have a bird unless the person who is shechting it has a masorah from somebody else that he saw this bird shechting. So that's why there was a big question, there is still a big question about, let's say, turkey. Turkey, the new bird. So there still are some poskim who won't eat turkey because they feel there is no real tradition for it. Others disagree. Rabbi Dan Center was here a couple of years ago and he spoke about this particular topic. So that's the Ramah. The Chachmas Adam says this applies to meat as well, not just poultry. You see, when it comes to poultry, the Torah does not give us any defining features. It just says, here are the birds that you can't eat. So the Torah basically doesn't give us the tools that we need in order to distinguish on our own whether or not a bird is kosher or not. The truth is, Chazal point out that all kosher birds have certain common features, but there's an idea of Masorah. But they're extending this even to animals where you could just check. It either has the two necessary simanim or not. But if this is true, then you could say, well, we don't have a masorah for giraffe, right? You could say, my mother made great chicken soup, great gefilte fish, some other weird things that people from Hungarian descent made, but giraffe? Really? How disappointing, he writes. However, he says, there may still be a glimmer of hope for those who still want to eat giraffe. Rav Sadiago and the Radak and the Targum Shivim define the biblical zemer is the giraffe. An argument that can be made that this positive identification should suffice as the Masorah requirement. If giraffe meat were to come into vogue, we would need a final ruling on this issue. In other words, the Torah specifically says, speaks about a zemer. A zemer is being a kosher animal. Now, if a zemer is a giraffe, as is argued by Rav Sadio and the Radak and the Targum Shivim, so then there is, what more Masorah do you need than that? The Torah itself says that a giraffe is kosher. But the bottom line is, a giraffe may be shechted, and one could easily identify the proper place to perform the shechita. Next week, we will meet for the final topic in this series. These are the things of the past, Jewish history myths. Thank you again. Have a wonderful night.